Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still a goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
This week, my guest is the one and only Mikkel Kessler. He's a Danish legend. He's the Viking warrior. You'll be able to hear, I have so much respect for Mikkel Kessler, as I do for all of those guys at 168 pounds who fought each other. He did fight them all. Obviously, when you look at three of the best in recent times, you're looking at Joe Calzaghe, you're looking at Andre Ward, and you're looking at Karl Froch, and he fought all of them. And this is even before he'd sort of unified and fought the likes, or sorry, this is even after he'd fought the likes of Anthony Mundine, Eric Lucas, Marcus Beyer to unify the titles at 168. It's interesting, you know, I haven't heard a bad word about Kessler ever on the circuit or from anyone. And it's interesting that even as you're here in this podcast, that the usual trash talking of Anthony Mundine, apparently he was very respectful of Kessler. And why wouldn't you be, really? He's not just an easygoing guy, but he is a warrior through and through. He fights with his heart and with a great deal of skill. He leaves it all out there. He's been brilliant value for money his entire career. It was a real privilege to catch up with him. It's the longest interview I've done with him. We've spoken a few times in the past. Press conferences before and after the Froch fights and the Calzaghe fight and so forth. We never met during the Denmark days when I was there with Ray Mercer ahead of his fight with Brian Scott on that Brian Nielsen, Mike Tyson bill. But he was on that bill. I remember watching him fight on that bill. It's a great story. And I hope that you guys find the sound quality okay. I was actually recording one with Peter Buckley for next week, the triple centurion journeyman. It didn't sound great at all, so I've had to abort that and I'll go and see Peter another time. I did get someone who complained about the sound quality of the Andy Lee podcast last week. I am trying my best to provide this content while we're in lockdown and obeying social distancing rules and everything that's being chucked our way, and that does mean me trying different ways to bring you the best sound quality that I can. It's a challenge, especially with a guy who's not particularly tech savvy, and it also helps if you've got someone tech savvy the other end. So it's always going to be quite a challenge, but I'll keep trying. That's the one thing I'll promise. I'll keep trying to adapt and improve as we go along. Hopefully you enjoy this with Mikkel. I think the quality is good. I think it is better than last week's. And that's, you know, it's not that I've done anything differently. It's just down to the quality of the line. I think, you know, we're all in the same boat doing stuff on Zoom or Skype or Clean Feed or WhatsApp. And it's a challenge for so many people who aren't tech savvy, who don't have big corporations behind them or big budgets and microphones in different places and all the rest of it. So it's a challenge, but we'll keep going. Fortunately, I have been able to do a lot of work elsewhere, not just on the podcast. I've got into big interviews with David Hay and Tony Bellew up on the Rings website. I've got a couple of pieces with Eddie Hearn on Boxing Scene, as well as my normal column going up on a Friday on the Boxing Scene website. So keeping busy with a lot of boxing related stuff. I'm hoping to speak to Nigel Benn for Ring Magazine this week. Hope to get Nigel on the podcast in the near future, but that will likely be in person or hopefully in person. So watch this space. With regards to this pod, it is important I remind you each week that it wouldn't be going ahead now or previously without the support of Blaz at Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm for 2020 at the Corporate Excellence Awards. And they've been proud sponsors of Boxing Life Stories for getting on for 60 episodes, I believe. Not only do they find the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more about them at hansonlee.com. www.thebigmanshow.com. And I can't thank them enough for their help and their support. And I'll leave you now with the brilliant Mikkel Kessler. Mikkel, it's great to see you, man. You've given me some of my best memories ringside. I was at both Froch fights. I was at the Calzaghe fight. In fact, I was at one of the very early fights when you fought in the undercard of Brian Nielsen and Mike Tyson in the Parken.
Oh, yeah. In Parken in Denmark.
Yeah, that's right. So, but you have given me some fabulous memories. So it's been
a privilege
to come. Yeah, thanks. It's been a privilege to cover your career. What are you doing these days? You seem to have been having a lot of family time.
Yeah, you know, I now got three kids, so it's a lot of work. But of course, I have some companies that I'm working on also, and I'm make, what do you call in English, speeches? I am in speech for people.
Oh, like after dinner speaking, motivational speaking and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, motivational and for companies and how, why did I became the best of my sport in my sport? And, you know, talking about good memories and the bad ones, of course. And all my career, I'm doing a lot of that, and I'm training people. And I have an entrepreneur company, you know, building houses.
And you live a quiet life, though, don't you? Although you're busy, you like a quiet life. You're a private guy.
Yeah. I don't know how private I am. You know, now we have Instagram and we are also working on a TV show here. With my family, where we're going traveling all around the world. We were actually stuck in New Zealand when the corona came.
And you had to go home because you were kept in New Zealand for a bit, weren't you? And then you had to go home.
Yes, that's right. For 14 days, we were in quarantine. And everything worked out good, and we are back home.
Yeah, ready to go again. Because you've been to Bali and other places, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, good.
You know your stuff.
I've done some research. Hey, I know a bit more about your boxing stuff than the stuff away from boxing, that's fair to say. So, Mikkel, can you tell us why you started boxing in the first place? Because it's fair to say Denmark isn't really known for its boxing.
No, it's... I started when I was around 13 years old. My other friends, they play football and you know, taekwondo, and I actually saw Brian Nielsen in television under the Olympics, and then I said, why doesn't some of my friends go to this sport? Because I think it was it was a challenge for me, I think, to try that. So my mother, she looked up in the yellow books that we have in Denmark. You also probably have it in England, the yellow books. And then we found a boxing club, and I came there with two of my friends and started from scratch. And the two of my friends, they stopped one after 2 months and one after 2 years. And I just kept going and got a lot of new friends there, and I just love coming to the boxing training and being with the guys over there.
Did you have any boxing heroes?
Not at first, but of course I had my father. He took me to a lot of fights when I was younger, but it didn't interest me as much then. But then when I started myself, we can go to the fights together. And then I started to, you know, Johnny Bredahl.
Yeah, Johnny Bredahl. Yeah.
Yeah, Bredahl. And we had some good guys here in Denmark. A guy called Sean Søndergaard and Gert Bo, and we had Mads Larsen also. There were some good names there.
Thomas Damgaard was around then as well.
Thomas Damgaard also, yeah.
Yeah. You did you like the other sports, or was it always boxing for you?
Oh, I played football for around 5-6 years when I was around 7 to 13.
Okay, and were you always good at boxing? Was it something that came naturally to you?
No. My trainer then, he told me, Rikard Olsen, he told me that I had a talent, but I didn't have the greatest talent, but I was willing to work for it, you know. I didn't have a day off from training. I got the training medal when we had these parties at the end of the year. I always got the training medals because I always been there. And I worked hard for it. And when I saw myself getting better and better, when I became a European champion in youth when I was 16 years old, I became a European champion. And then I could see that I had maybe something that the other fighter didn't.
What did your parents think as you started to take it more seriously? Did they want you to do something else?
Yeah, my father, you know, like they said, you have nothing to fall back on, you know, because I was a mechanic for 2.5 years as an education, and I had to drop out when I got pro. I turned pro when I was 18, and he said, it's stupid, you have to, you know, I want to support you, but I think it's stupid if you don't finish your exam and then you can box after. But it was too much for me because I ran in the morning, I went to job 8 hours, and then I trained boxing in the evening. So it was too much for me.
Yeah, that's a hard schedule.
So I had to cut off something.
Your mother lived in Salisbury for a while, which is very close to me. I'm about 8 miles from Salisbury and used to live there. How did that come about?
Yeah, you know, my mother, she moved to Denmark when she was around 2022. I have a big brother in England, lives in Lincoln. Yeah, his name is Mark Coleman, and he's, what is his today, 58 or something? 60, almost 60, I think. And I didn't see him. He was raised by my mother's parents, actually, because it's a long story.
So
couldn't stand her mother, and she just want to. She got the child, and then she left, and then she came to Denmark and met my sister's father, and she got my older sister, and she got her. And 13 years after, she met my father, and then she got me. So we always been very close, me and my mother and my older sister. But then for around 10 years ago, we took contact to my big brother in England, and then we had a good relationship since. So
did you come to Salisbury? Have you been to Salisbury?
Never been to Salisbury.
Okay. As a kid, you know, you mentioned about football and boxing. Were you ever in any trouble?
No, you know, we were like, how can you say it? We were the kids that we like trouble, but you know, I think boxing also took me away from that,
yeah,
from the troublemakers. And because I have so much in training and boxing, and I was too tired to make too much trouble after training. And still, of course, I know all the guys still, and I still keep in contact with all my old friends. And but I think, you know, if I look back at it, you know, I think boxing helped me to another path of my future.
At what point did you get into riding motorbikes?
Oh, it was in 2000 and I was 24, how much is it? It's around 16 years ago.
Oh, okay. So not when you were a kid, a bit older then.
Yeah. We had moped.
Okay.
We had this moped. We were tuning, and you know, but then I wanted a racing machine, and in my contract I couldn't have one. But I did it anyway.
Yeah, Kala says you're an insane speed freak.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Kelly says so much bullshit. I like speed. I have some fast cars, and I have some veteran American muscle cars, and I like that, you know. And I actually sold all my motorbikes a couple of years ago.
Because you're a dad now and it's too dangerous?
Yeah, my heart sometimes, it was stuck in the throat, you know. You have to be careful when you go on a bike. I have my cars and it's good for me. And if you have a bike, it's important you have something to ride with, because then you go like for 2 hours a year, because there's no, you don't want to ride your motorcycle alone. I think it's boring.
Kala also said that you and Arthur were both into fast cars and fast bikes, but he said that Arthur was a bad driver.
That's good. So I think I'm an okay driver, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't say otherwise. He said that you were okay. He just said that you were into them. So as an amateur, you were 44-3, is that right?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Was it a disadvantage for you being in Denmark as an amateur? You know, when you think of these boxing hotbeds like the UK, like the USA, is it harder for you guys to get a break?
What do you mean, Trish?
Sorry, I mean, is it harder to get noticed when you're from somewhere like Denmark?
Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yes. It is, of course, you come from a small country. As my old promoter, Morgan Spalle, he said, you know, he always said that we should have been in the States or Germany or somewhere else, because it's, or England, because it's very small country. It's difficult to get the scene, you know?
Yeah, to get the attention.
Yeah, attention, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I think I had a good career and I was spotted early and I just wanted to get pro. I wanted to make some money and do something for a living. That was my first thing. And then when I started, I wanted to, after like 5 or 10 fights, I wanted to be the world champion. And I knew there was a long way to being a world champion. So, of course, I looked up at some fighters. I saw a lot of Oscar De La Hoya fights, and I was getting better and better every year. Each fight, I was improving and training. And suddenly I just had one wish, that was becoming a world champion, you know?
You had an early fight in Las Vegas, didn't you? Like in 2000 on a card with Bones Adams and a couple of other big names.
That's right. That was with, I think it was Johnny Bradel. He had a world title fight. At Mandalay Bay, Vegas.
Was that your first trip to Vegas?
Yeah. I remember very clear, because I was turning 21 at that time, and I couldn't get into the casinos before I was 21. And it was like one day before, and I said, I'm 21 tomorrow. And they say, you're not coming before tomorrow. So Brian Nilsson, he had to play my dad.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So we had a lot of fun over there, and I fought, I can't remember this guy I fought. You know, I knocked him out after the second round. So I was at the top of my game over there.
I was actually training in Pleasantville with Brian Nilsson and Thomas Damgaard when they were over. Brian Nilsson was over sparring with Ray Mercer. And then Ray Mercer came back to fight on that big bill in Denmark in the Parken when Tyson fought Nilsson.
Yeah. Okay.
What was that night at the Parken like in Denmark when Tyson fought Nilsson? Because I remember it was crazy, absolutely crazy, being ringside.
Yeah, we had almost full house there, and I remember people paying like a lot of money for ringside tickets. It was crazy. And they were all talking about it here in Denmark. It was a big, big event, of course, when you have Mike Tyson over there, over here. And it was, I remember the night I had to fight some Mexican guy there. I can't remember his name, of course.
David Mendez.
Yeah, you know. And it was a great night. Also for the upcoming fights for me. And I was just ready because you've never been fighting for so many people before. So it was...
Brian walked out to always look on the bright side of life. Do you remember?
Yeah. Always, yeah.
And a young Joe Calzaghe fought on that bill. He fought Will McIntyre. Did you meet Joe that night?
No, I didn't meet him. I watched him because they were trying to get him some fights. I had some trouble getting him some fights, I remember. And then he came to Denmark to fight this guy, and he did good. And I said, I want to fight that guy one day.
Wow, okay.
He is the best, they told me, and he's going to be the best and blah, blah. And at that time, I remember that I wanted to fight this guy one day. And I will beat him, I told him.
You took a big step up against the South African Dingaan Thabola. You widely outscored him. That was a breakthrough fight of sorts because he was like a gatekeeper, wasn't he?
Yeah. That's right. That was one of my jumps. You're right. One of my jumps. One of my first 12 rounds fights, and I got like. I think it was 2 weeks' notice for the fight.
Okay.
But I was always in shape, but and I never had, you know, boxed 12 rounds, so it was new to me, of course, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And but I had his fight. I won every round, but he just kept on going in this Rose of Africa, what they called him.
You said you were in good shape. You're always in good shape. You're still in good shape now. You still got a six pack going on.
Yeah. Four pack.
Four pack. So where do you train? You train at home?
Yeah, I have a little gym at home. I have actually a boxing ring and some weights and what I need, you know.
Okay.
And, so I'm very happy at these times.
Yeah, sure.
Put it that way.
you then had a string of good wins over Henry Porras, Julio Cesar Green, and Andre Tise, and then Manny Siaka. Did you know after those guys that you were world class?
I remember that if you wanted to be a world champion, it should be one of the big belts and the big title fight, the big champions. But what was the big titles? And I remember WBA was the big one. And then Mads Larsen, if you remember him.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
He had an injury before the fight, always, or like 2 weeks before. And Morgan Spurlock, he tried to get me on the fight instead of him. And I got the fight. And I tried for, at that time, I tried to fight Sven Otke, if you remember him.
Yeah.
And they all of them said no. They you know, the purse was not right. Or I think they were afraid of me at that time. I was an upcoming fighter, and you want to avoid them sometimes.
So you ended up going on the road to Australia.
Yeah. So first I fought, of course, Manny Siaka and won the world title, and I was so happy. But because I had this fight because Mads Larsen, he was injured. Then I had to go to Australia, and they won the purse offer at that time. And I came to fight Mundine there, yeah. On my first title defense.
How good was Mundine?
I think he was good. You know, at that time he was good. He was a strange fighter, awkward fighter. He was fast. He was loud in his mouth, and he was, you know. But the one thing they told me in Australia was that he had a lot of respect for me that he didn't have with any other fighters he fought. So I think that was a little funny.
But I think that's true, and that sort of takes me on to your next fight when you beat Eric Lucas. He said at the time, and I was doing some research on this yesterday, he said you were the best he faced bar Roy Jones, which is a good compliment because he fought a lot of good names, Eric Luca.
Yeah, that's right. We had a good fight. I remember before the fight, I injured the hand. I had an operation a month or two before. So I was afraid of punching it so I would be bad again in the fight. So I kept it on. If you've seen the fight, I'm using my left the first 6 or 7 rounds, not very much my right hand. And then after, I'm just starting to get him, you know, he's bleeding. He can't avoid my left jab. And suddenly, you know, he's bleeding and I'm starting to get the right. And then I'll actually finish the fight. But I had a lot of respect for Eric Lucas. He was a great fighter.
And then there was a big fight back in Denmark, a huge night because you fought Marcus Beyer.
Yeah, that was
in a unification.
Yeah,
was that a grudge fight or did you guys get on well?
We got on well. He was a nice guy, and he passed away. I heard, you know, a couple of years ago, right. Marcus Beyer. We had a good fight, but then after that fight, if I can jump in it a little bit, I went to Sauerland and I came down to Germany to train with Uli Wegner. He's not training me, but he was training other fighters, but I was training in his gym and he was there and he told me. Every day I came, he said, Marcus Beyer, when you knocked him out, he could have gone up again. I don't understand why he stayed down. He said that to me every day. And I said, I don't think he could get up, Oli. Yes, he could. And he was so mad every day.
Brilliant.
So it was, I hit him right where I should in that fight. It was one of my biggest fights because it was a unification. And to get those two belts was of course a big dream for me.
Yeah, of course. And then you fought the tough Liberato Andrade, and then it was Calzaghe in a unification in the Millennium Stadium in Wales. People thought that was a 50-50 fight going in. What was your expectation ahead of the fight?
Oh, I knew it's going to be a hard day at work. I knew that. It's actually a long story with Joe because we were fighting and I think it was meant to be in September, first time. And I trained very hard, was ready for the fight. And then Joe, he got sick or injured or something. So they canceled the first date. And then we fought again in November. Yeah, I can't remember when. November, the 4th of November, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I remember I'm having a break just a week because I was training too hard. So I had to don't get too in over shape or too much training. So, and then I came back on the track and I just fought and fought and fought. And every time I was thinking about Calzaghe when I was out running, when I was boxing, everything was about Calzaghe. I remember, you know, because this was it. And remember going into that ring, I can tell you it was, I couldn't, there were about 6,000 Danish people actually over there and supporting. So I think it was for a little country, for like Denmark, it's a lot of people. And they came over, but I couldn't hear one Danish people or man or nobody. I could only hear Wales or an English people shouting Calzaghe. So it was somewhat of a shock for me coming in. But still, I was ready. And this big event, it was first time that what is the ring announcer? What is his name?
Buffer, Michael Buffer.
Buffer. When he shouted my name in the ring, you know, Joe Gatage and Michael Kessler and the Viking Warrior, and I couldn't hear him. So I didn't know when to raise my hand, you know, when to... I could not hear him so much loud. I never tried that before in all of my career. And then I thought to myself, too, I thought, okay, what the fuck are you doing here? That was, oh, shit. What have I done? But, you know, it went well in the start, and he was adapting good, Joe. You know, I had him with some good uppercuts, and he had me with some good body shots in the later rounds. And actually, I think it depends what the judges say. Of course, he was home, but still, I think it was a very 50-50 fight at the end.
But you haven't complained about the scores at all, have you?
No. I think it was okay, and I never said any bad excuses. I had broken my hand around 1 month before the fight.
How did he change tactics midway through the fight? Because, like you said, it was close in the start, very close, and I think he'd agree that maybe you were physically stronger at the start, and then he was better towards the end of the fight. What changed?
That's right. Yeah, but he was good to like adapt to my boxing style. He was good, you know, doing some other stuff. He tried to attack me with all his punches. He punches, you know, a lot. Then I came back and punched him back, and he got hit a lot. So he found out that he shouldn't attack me that much, and just, you know, how do you say that in English?
Cautious, respectful.
But he didn't want any respect. He wanted to tease me. Okay. He wanted to tease me all the time, so I could make the flaws and he can come back, you know.
So he wanted to counter you. You bait you into making him be the aggressor, so he could counter you.
Yeah, that's right. So he was, you know, he was, and I can't take that away from him. I don't. When you are in the ring, 12 rounds, you don't know who's gonna win. But when I saw it after on my television at home, I think it's still that day today. It's rather difficult to see who is the winner, because does Galsaki's punches count when it's not that hard and it's not hitting me really? And does my hard punches count? You know, but at the end, I think it was okay. He won that fight, actually.
Do you know?
And I said to him,
yeah.
What?
No, sorry. Yeah, you said to him.
And I said to him after the fight, I took him into a room. I said, Joe, I said, we have to have a rematch. I told him. And he said, come here, Vic. He said, Kessler, it was my night tonight and not anymore. He said.
Brilliant.
So, you know, we became friends, and you know, we always talked a little bit, and I visited him and then he fought Hopkins and Roy Jones after his last fights, and I was there for them.
Yeah,
and
that's
also right. For the
because do you know
after party.
Do you know what a bromance is?
Bromance.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you and Joe kind of have a bromance going on, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. obviously, when you say about Hopkins and Jones, he moved up to light heavyweight, and so you stayed at 168. You had four wins to get back on track, which you did, and you won the belt against Sartison again, if I remember correctly.
It was because he was throwing the belt because he went up in light heavy. So now I had the chance of fighting for the WBA again.
And you beat Sartison, and then you were heading into the Super Series, which was a violent tournament with, you know, there was you, Darrell, Taylor, Andre Ward, Arthur, and Carl Froch. You also split with Mogens, by the way, which you did touch upon earlier, but that wasn't a happy split, was it?
No. I had like almost 1 year when I didn't know where, if I'm going to fight anymore or what was going to happen. So
Those politics are stressful for fighters, aren't they?
Yeah, because, you know, I trusted him. And when you fight, you wanted to fight, you want to trust your promoter, you want to trust your manager. So I had to change them out, because you have to be a little businessman yourself, because it's they will take all your hard-earned money, you know?
Or your blood money.
Yeah, my blood money, yeah.
And you joined the Sauerlands. What was it about the Sauerlands that you liked?
As I tell people, they are not they're not better than Mons Pallet, but I was getting quicker at the years gone by. No, you know, they had a lot. You know, I had some talks with them, and I wanted to come to a place where they took care of one another. You know, that's why I was going to Germany to train. They're gonna put me there to train. They're gonna train this. They're gonna do the best for me, so I can be the best of myself when I'm going to the ring. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
of course. It's like it was important for me that we had everything contractual signed and everything was good. And then I could train and then I can focus on the boxing, not focus so much on the other things.
The Super Series was, the lineup was spectacular. What were your thoughts going into it? Did you think that you were a clear favorite? Because I think that you were the favorite maybe going into it.
Yeah, there was a lot of favorites. Yeah, I was one of the favorites, that's right, at the time. Of course, going into that and going against Andrew Ward in my first fight, I don't want to remember that fight because it was so difficult for me when I was training over there and how they pushed me around and how they said, yeah, I have so many excuses. And they were good at stressing me at that time. Really good. You know, I had to go to the eye doctor. I had to go 3 hours that way and 3 hours back. And we had, all that. And, you know, the press conference, the press meetings, they say we have to be inside, and it was cold out there at that time. And I came in a t-shirt, and it was outside. You know, and I had to borrow a jacket at someone, and, you know, it was everything. You know, the sparring partner, they filmed the sparring over there and gave it to Andrew Ward. So there was a lot of stuff there, but looking back, you know, Andrew Ward was a good fighter. He's not fighting anymore, but he was a good fighter at that time. He was so awkward, and he had the judge or the referee on his side in that fight. And I was just trying to have a clean fight and trying to get him. And that was a really bad fight. I lost, and I wanted to fight Andrew Ward again, but it was impossible to make that fight.
The one thing that people say about Andre Ward, the guys who faced him, say that, yes, he does have some moves and he is quite physical. People are surprised at how strong he is.
No, I don't think he was strong. He was fast.
Yeah.
He had fast arms. He was awkward. You know, he has like one style of going in and holding and punching and holding and making points on you all the time. He doesn't want to fight, you know, if you know what I mean. He really doesn't want to have a fair fight.
A shootout.
He wants to get in and he wants to hold you and he wants to, so he makes you fight his style and you will get like frustrated. That's the name for it. He's the best of getting you frustrated in that ring.
Did you actually count that he held you 88 times? Is that a thing? Did you look back at the tape and count 88?
Yeah, and I tried to push him at the time. And the doctor, you know, had some cuts off his head, only for his head.
Yeah.
And he headbutted me, I don't know how many times. And the referee didn't do anything, and I told him between the rounds that he is headbutting, man. Can you see that? You got to give him a warning or disc him or something. And the referee would go like, no, it's no, that's how it is. But but the most, the thing I remember the most is that I think it's the 10th round, 11th round, and I said to myself, okay, I know I lost this fight. I knew that at that time. Now I'm going to go in. I'm like, just going to give him war, you know. I don't care if he holds or what. I'm just going to throw everything I have. So I went in and I start throwing. And then the doctor stops me. And say, ah, you got to look at that cut. And we got that cut very nice. So it's not, nothing can do, nothing can come into my eyes. The cut cannot get into my eyes. So, you know, all that stuff. And everything is very good. The cut man was very good in my corner. And the doctor says, I said, come on, two more rounds. You know, it's like, what do you mean? And he said, no, we have to stop it. And I said, but don't worry, you can still win on punch. So then I think maybe they were afraid of me coming back or maybe hit and reward with something, you know, something powerful or lucky, a lucky shot, if you could say it like that.
Yeah. How disappointed were you to lose for the first time? I mean, well, obviously I know you lost to Joe, but how, you know, Joe was sort of on his way to the Hall of Fame by then, but
of course it was a big disappointment. I just changed to Sauerland and I was ready and I was frustrated and everything that happened over there. And I just said, I have to forget that, you know, I have to forget that and just go home and do a lot of tricks with Jimmy Montoya.
Yeah,
I had Jim Montoya after that fight because my trainer, Richard Olsen, he was not there, you know. He couldn't really, he was getting old at that time. I was losing the respect and he wasn't good enough in those fights as he used to be. Actually, Richard today is having, we call it dementia.
Dementia, yes, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it started already at that time.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I got Jim Montoya, and then we started to, I wanted to fight Andrew Ward, of course, again someday. So I started to train all the, when they hold you and when you, how you can get out and all that stuff. I used a lot of time on that if I have to fight in again. And we tried for so long with Sauerland to try to fight him, but he doesn't want to come out of the U.S. I wanted to fight over there, but then they would give me like nothing.
Sure.
So it's like another way to say no.
And with the Super 6, though, there were no easy fights to come back in. Your fight after Andre Ward was Karl Frotch in Herning.
That's a good fight.
That was a brilliant fight. It makes me scared for you guys in your future that you guys hit each other that much. So hard. I was right there. I was on the ring apron. Kala gave me a seat right there in the corner, and it was hard to watch. It was like you guys were just knocking lumps out of each other. It was incredible, but I felt guilty watching it.
Yeah. Okay. That's not good. it was not the most technical fight. It was a brawl, you know, and of course all the so-called professional boxing journalists and so on, they said, Mikkel Kessler, he's finished. He's going to get a whooping by Frotch. Everybody said that, you know, because you lost once, and when people don't understand boxing, they don't know how it was. So I wanted also to show them that I was still there. I had a bad fight with Ward, and I'm over that, now I'm going to show them that I'm coming back. So I just gave it all. And I remember Jimmy Montoya telling me in the 11th or 12th round, you're behind on points, man. You gotta, if you want to win, you got to go out there and win. Shit. I said, fuck it. And I just came out and went in like a storm.
And you mentioned the crowd at the Millennium Stadium. The crowd in Herning was one of the best I've ever experienced.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Like, like Frank, he told me after, he said, Mikkel, you know, when I went in that crowd, I was getting goosebumps because it was, I really didn't see that coming, he told me.
And of course, you know, Carl would have won that fight had it not been for the ash cloud from the volcano, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I remember that at our second fight, I said to him, please tell the people you lost that fight, fair and square. And he said, Mikkel, okay, everyone, I lost that fight.
The thing is, I mean, even though obviously Carl said about the ash cloud, you couldn't, with that fight, the first fight in Herning, before we go on to the second one, is you guys just have so much respect, not just from the public and the fight fans, but for one another, having shared a fight like that.
Yeah, you know, it's always good to be with a man who wants to fight. You know, he's standing there and he wants to fight. And that's and he was undefeated at that time, Frotch, and he had he was mentally very, very strong, I remember. You know, he had like this look, I cannot lose anything.
And you had the same look.
Yeah, and I was like, you're gonna lose today.
After a fight like that, when it's such a bruising and hard fight, how long does it take for you and your body and your head to go back to normal?
After that fight, I remember I was pissing blood, I think, in that fight. After, and I will say you cannot sleep then that night. Maybe get an hour, maybe 2 hours, but when you go up in the morning, every joint in your body is sore. And it's not because you got hit, but it's because you push your body to the, yeah, what do you call it?
The limit, to the extremes, yeah.
Yeah, so you, every joint, everything, and I always, after such fight, I have the one you get under your feet, what do you call it? If you are running like 50 kilometers, you will get something.
Oh, blisters, blisters.
Blisters. Yeah, and it's funny because you train in those boxing shoes for a while to get used to them and gone a lot of boxing rounds in the gym. And then you go 12th round and you have these big blisters all over. So it's just this thing that because you're giving it so much of your strength and, yeah, mentally, and you don't feel anything. You just box for your life.
And that was you done in the Super Six.
Yeah, then I got with my eyes. I had a big problem with my eyes. I still have.
Do you? Was it from that fight?
No. It was a training camp in Germany. I was fighting with Stevenson.
Adonis Stevenson.
Adonis.
Okay.
He was a sparring partner for Arthur Abraham.
Okay.
And he was kicking Arthur Abraham's ass, so I got him.
The old 1-2.
Yeah, and he was just a guy from Canada, just going around sparring and asked me about managing and manager and what he could do. And he was old at that time, but he was so strong. And I remember hitting me in the back of the head a little bit in the spine. I remember I had to watch out all the time because he was, you know, punching so hard. It was crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
And I remember I'm telling my physical trainer after, when you're really tired, you can see a little double vision, you know. And I thought, just because I'm tired. But it stayed there. And also after the war fight, it still stayed there a little bit. And then after the first fight, I could see something was wrong, you know. So it came it came quiet. But yeah, and suddenly it was really bad. And I went to eye doctor and it was, when I look at you like this, I see double.
Okay.
I have two twitches.
two for the price of one. You did take nearly a year out there after the Froch fight, and you had a comeback fight. You had one fight in 2 years before you fought Alan Green. You stepped up to light heavyweight, and you beat Alan Green with one of the knockouts of the year in 2012.
That's right.
Was that to test yourself at light heavyweight, or was that just to, because you didn't weigh close to light heavyweight? I think you weighed about 169 and something.
Yeah. I was eating good food, you know, I was training good, and I always been very serious about that, about living good and healthy, and it's to get my shape to be better than the other fighters. You know, if you get 5 or 10% more in the later round, you know, it's you're going to win the fight. Ooh. And so against Alan Green, I remember he had trouble making the light heavyweight. So actually he came down to, what was it, 89 point something, 79 point something kilos.
Okay.
Yeah, so, but I was under, I tried to drink some water to get up, and I could not get up. I was in so good shape, and I was nervous. Not nervous, I was, you know, I was excited and for that fight, so he was a lot bigger than me in that fight.
There were some people that probably would have said that he was the puncher going into that as well.
Yeah, he could punch Alan Green, and he was strong, and he got me in the first round, actually. A little bit. Like I said, they were counting. There were a count on me in the first round, but I would say today they should never have been a count.
Okay. And was the was the knockout punch, was that the best punch of your career?
Yeah, one of the best ones, of course.
And then there was Brian McGee, the usually durable Irishman, who was a good fighter, but he lasted into the third round with you.
Yeah.
In fact, that fight, I think it was in Herning, but another thing that Calla was saying was how much, and you touched upon it there about your preparation, you had this farmhouse that Calla loved spending time with you there, but he was talking about how good you were with your preparation in the sense that you ordered in meat from the local butchers, fish from the local fishermen, all local produce, and you sourced all yourself. You had a chef, and he was talking about how professional you were in camp.
Yeah, always. You know, I didn't want to save any money on that. I want to be the best of myself in that fight. As I told you before, it was very important for me that I had a chef, as a physical trainer, and had a boxing trainer. And the physical trainer, as I work with today, his name is Thomas McCong. Known him for 15 years. He was with me because I had back injuries at the Mundin fight. At the Mundin fight, I only fought 20 rounds of boxing before that fight. Because of my disc problems I had in my back. So he helped me from there. And then he started to telling me how much I should eating vegetables. And so he's been the man who's been helping me a lot. And he's been telling the chef what to make for us at dinner and lunch and breakfast, what I had to eat. So, you know, it's been very professional.
So he's the man behind the four pack.
Yeah. Yeah. the two pack now.
It's getting less as we go on. Tell me about Brian McGee.
Brian McGee, I have a big, much respect for that guy. A really, really nice guy, actually. You know, I hit him hard in the stomach. He tries to go up, and I hit him again. I remember I was watching his fight against not Eric, what is his name, the other Canadian?
Lucien Boutet.
Lucien Boutet, yeah. I was over there watching the fight, and I remember he was killing him in the body. Boutet was killing Brian McGee in the body. So I watched his fight and I could see how open he was for that. So we had a lot of training for that fight.
Okay. And then you got your rematch, or Carl got his rematch with you. He was also on form because he'd beaten Lucien Boutte. He'd also beaten, I think, Youssef Max since he fought you. This time you came over to England and you fought in the O2 arena, and it was equally, some people would say equally violent. I'd say it wasn't as rough as the first fight, but it was still I wasn't in it, so it's easy for me to say. It was still a very violent fight, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. From Wales, the light heavyweight champion then. What was his name?
Nathan Cleverley.
Nathan Cleverley over sparring. I had George Groves over and sparring. I had Eric Skoglund sparring. I had these guys sparring for 1 week, and I promise you, I never had any better sparring. I was so good. I never been so that good in sparring ever.
I think George told me that you put him down.
George?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I didn't put him down, no. But I had him.
Okay.
If you can say it like that, because he would only have 4 rounds with me, and he was fast, but I was so good at that time. And then I fought cleverly, and I beat him. And he couldn't, and his trainer, I remember his trainer after, he said, "You have to do this and this and this." And I was moving around. And I said, "I'm going to beat Carl Frost again." And then I had to go 10 rounds with Cleverly, my last sparring. And after the 4th round, I got so tired. Got so tired. So I fought the 10th round, but it was more Cleverly at that sparring. I can say that. And then I took 2 days. Totally off training, because I was in overshape, or what do you call it?
You peaked. You peaked.
I peaked. I was overpeaked. You know, I peaked way too early, and I never tried that in my whole career. But I think that I got some break, and I thought I would be there ready. I thought I was ready for Carl, and I remember I'm always a good finisher. Trish, always a good finisher. In 11th and 12th rounds, I'm always like with Jigalsaki, I won the 12th round fight in that fight, because I'm always a good finisher, always have been. But in that fight, I was so tired, and Carl was finishing the game there. So,
well, I remember from being ringside, I don't know how it affects you guys when you're in there. I did feel that in Herning, the crowd, you responded to the crowd roaring, and Carl didn't have that. And I felt it was the same in the O2 when in the later rounds, that Carl surged from the crowd, and this time you didn't have that.
Yeah, maybe right. But I didn't have any energy.
Sure.
I was mad at myself of not having that energy left. You know, I was, And I remember having Carl in the 11th round. I shot him. His eyes were all away, and I thought, now I have him. I got him now. And then I didn't have the power to finish it off. So great fight again, and a great fight for Carl coming back. And as I tell some people, I said, I never got the rematch against Joe. So I, of course, Carl should have that rematch against me. Always.
You were in part responsible for this rivalry between Frotch and Groves, because the fact that you'd had George over sparring to help you prepare for the Frotch fight. You know, the people were asking Carl at the time, do you think it's a lack of patriotism with George going over to spar the Danish guy in Denmark when he's preparing to fight the English guy in England? So you played your part in that.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. They had some good fights there.
You wanted that third fight. You talk about obviously doing the honours and giving Carl the rematch, but you wanted a decider. You wanted a third fight for the longest time.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Carl saying we maybe had to fight one more time. I just wanted to have a break. I actually said to Carl, I remember, I would think about it right now. I said, I just wanted to, you know, relax, and I got a kid on the way, and so I just wanted to see my newborn kid and see what's going to happen, because I was tired of this hard fight, as Rush he also tells me. You can be tired of these hard fights, you know. You have to train so hard. It's the training up to the fight. It's the 3-4 months up to the fight that's hard, you know. All those rounds, all this planning, and the right food, the right training, and all that. That's the hard stuff. And I think Carl's he says that to me, that he feels the same way. But I remember the decider, it came out when I wanted to have when I made a comeback a yes. couple of years ago. I wanted a decider. And Carl, he was thinking about it, actually. But then he said, no, it's not going to happen.
That comeback you were training for, the comeback you were training for was to go back in a new World Boxing Super Series, wasn't it? It was to go back in with the one with Callum Smith, George Groves, and those guys. And then I believe you were out training with Eric Skoglund, and you got bitten by a tick.
That's right.
And then you got massively ill.
Yeah. I've been very ill for, I didn't know what it was, and I'm feeling bad. I was training and training, and suddenly I had to go to the hospital, and I was in the hospital for 1 week, and they found out that I had been bitten by a tick, and that was a big problem, you know. It's a brain bacteria, you call it.
Were you in real danger?
No. It was okay.
Yeah.
Of course, you are always in real danger when you have so much bacteria in the spine. It comes in your spine. It's called, what do you call in English, that disease? Because the tick can give you many kind of diseases.
Okay.
Yeah, I got one where you could get paralyzed in the face, and you can't talk, and it can be really, really serious. So, but I came over, and you know, I didn't have my heart with me. When I tried to come back, I tried to train, and I tried to, and my manager and my good friend Alan, he said, "We have to give something to the press. Are you coming back or not? Tell me. Give me 1 week," I said. And after that week, he said, "Give me 1 month, and I know it." And I couldn't get myself back. You know, I couldn't find this heart was this killing instinct was going away, and was
the eye of the tiger.
Yeah, you know, everything I go into, I do it 100%, and now I really could do it 100%, because I already trained a half a year, 6 months to get that shape. Almost that shape that I was in, and it was very hard to come there, and then I had to totally not train for 2 months, and then I had to start all over again. So it was a long way, and I couldn't it was too hard for me.
So that was it. 49 fights, and that was it. 49 and out,
and I was out. That's right.
Okay. How hard was it to cope with the idea that you couldn't get back that that identity, that hunger?
It was difficult at the start, actually, this hunger, this heart, this I wanted to, you know, I wanted to fight this guy, and I wanted the big fight. that was why if I wanted to make a comeback, I want to fight the big fights. I don't want to fight somebody I really don't know, and because then you can't get the warrior to come out, and it's very important. And but actually, when I told people that this was it, and I told people, everybody, that I'm done, I'm out, I cannot do it anymore, it actually is like a stone falling from the heart. It was like, now it's over. I don't have to think about anything. And you know, it was
relief.
Yeah. It's, there's a meaning with the life, you know?
Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, so many fighters struggle in retirement though, but you don't appear to have had those wobbles where you go off the rails with drink and drugs and all that stuff.
No, it's a waste of life, waste of time.
Is there anyone you didn't fight that you would like to have fought?
There was actually, I was close of fighting the Russian guy. You see, I don't remember his name.
Not Golovkin.
GGG, Golovkin.
Yeah. That was actually close.
Actually, we're trying to make a fight with him. It's not something I just know that he's a very good fighter. But I've seen a lot of his fights, and I think I have I would stand a good chance.
What about Kelly Pavlik, Bernard Hopkins? Did you come close to either of those guys?
No. Kelly Pavlik, we tried when I was at Morgan's Palace. At that time, I tried to fight see if I could fight Kelly Pavlik. It wasn't. I could not do that. We were all watching the fight, and with the German Taylor also tried him. At that time, it was before Frotch. And we couldn't make a deal at that time.
Would you have fought Arthur if you'd been drawn together in the Super Series?
Yeah, no problem.
Are you friends?
No, I'm not friends with Arthur.
Oh, okay.
I remember he didn't want to say to hello when we were in the Super Six, where we should go to the States and have a press conference for that and the commercial and all that stuff. Arthur didn't want to say hello to us.
Oh, really? Yeah, keeping the rivalry there.
Yeah, he didn't like that, okay. Actually. But then, but he was at the first fight too. And after that, he told Kelly that shit. After that fight, he said, "Oh,
yeah,
if I'm gonna fight Miguel the next time, then
Yeah, because Carl did a big job on Arthur.
Yeah.
Were you at that fight in Helsinki?
Yeah. I was at that fight.
So obviously there's this big debate raging in the UK right now about Joe and Carl, and Carl's talked about on his podcast that he should fight Joe now and all the rest of it. Like, you obviously fought both. Who was better?
I really don't know. Of course, I would say Joe, because Joe beat me and I beat Carl. But Joe was fast and Carl is not that fast. So I would say that Joe would have a better chance against Frotch. But he shouldn't get hit by Frotch.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to say. I know both of them. I like them both. And it's difficult to say who's going to win, because Joe in his prime times and Frotch in his prime times, it's as difficult. But Joe, he's smart. He's good at adapting. And like Ward, he adapted to Frotch. I think it would be a difficult fight for Frotch.
And while you and Carl are both right up there in terms of some of the very best guys at 168, obviously, Joe and Andre remained unbeaten, so I have to ask you, who would win, Joe and Andre, or who had the better career?
I would say Joe, of course, had the better career, and he would win over Andre Ward.
No further comment. But yeah,
I can comment that. Joe, you know, it's going to be a very boring fight because he's going to hold Ward all the time, and Joe's going to push him off. But I think he's going to adapt and wants to fight more than Ward wants to fight.
Yeah, and of course they both stepped up to 175, where Ward fought Kovalev as well and had his own wins up there.
Yeah.
Did you achieve everything that you wanted, Mikkel?
Yeah, I did. I did. Of course, I never got the four belts for that Millennium Stadium. That was one I've hoped for, if you can say it like that. But when something like that happens, you also know who's what the promoter do and not do, and then you get some other things done instead, and you take another path, and it takes you to another place, maybe a better place. So it's difficult to say, but of course, I wanted to have won that night. Of course, I would.
Did you want to have any of those? Obviously, I thought you thought Andre in Oakland, but did you want those big glamour nights in Madison Square Garden or in Las Vegas? Was that stuff that you wanted?
No, I've never been driven like the other fighters. Like, you should fight in Madison Square Garden. I said, I don't care. I think at O2 and Millennium, and I think that was the greatest for me. Madison Square Garden, maybe it's the place where the old fighters have fought through many years. But if you ask me, I don't care about that, for being honest.
You seem to be massively content. I think with your ring music, with your tattoos, with the stuff that you've endured, the fact that you're a fighter, you've been through some very dark periods of your life, but I can't put my finger on where they were. What were the darkest days for Mikkel Kessler?
The darkest days for me? I don't think I have so many dark days. Of course, all of us have them sometimes, but I don't think I have like a period of my life where I was all wear down and everything was shit, if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, depression, no, and all just, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, just no, I don't think I have that like that. Of course, sometimes in your life you have a period of time where it's not the best thing in the world, but I've always been strong mentally, and I'm never going to give up on something, and try to learn my kids that, you know.
Very much so. What was the last tattoo you had done?
I said many years ago. It's for Viking. I have a Viking on my back.
Okay.
And that's my last tattoo.
Oh, really? No more?
No more. No more.
Okay. Mikkel, it's been an absolute privilege to speak to you. I really appreciate your time.
I hope you can understand my bad English, because I have difficulty finding the words sometimes.
I think your English has got better over time, but I've never had a problem with your English. I think you always undersell yourself.
If I talk to you like for 2 days, it would be much better.
Brilliant. I could go on for 2 days. I really could, but I know that you couldn't. Even though I know we're all locked in anyway. Look, thank you very much for your time, Mikkel. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure.
Best wishes. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye, Chris. Bye.
So it was great to see Mikkel, who was a real warrior, and I'm glad he's home safe in Denmark, no longer on his travels, obviously having had that brief quarantine period in New Zealand. I think he's a really likable guy. He's clearly a big fan of Cal Zaghi and Froch, maybe not so much Andre Ward, but credit to Kessler for just being in that mix. He was an absolute handful for anyone. No one had an easy night against him. On the contrary, if you weren't a top tier guy, you were just going to lose to him. It's that simple. He was a top tier guy, one of the top 10 168 pounders. Just a straight up honest warrior. He pulls no punches and had a magnificent career. I thought he was going to sit on the fence more so than he did at the end there when I was asking about Kazagi. and Froch and Ward, but no, he was he nailed his colours to the mast and was great. And you know, I'm not sure that he does get the credit he's due for those big wins over Mundine, Lucas and Bayer. He was red hot then, absolutely red hot. And he's in the conversation with the top 10 168 pounders of all time, I think. Perhaps he could have done even more, but for injuries and the political situation with split with his promoter and so forth that we mentioned. But he's done more than enough, and he's given us a back catalogue of terrific fights. I'm hopeful to be on the line with Larry Merchant next week, but obviously we're in a changeable climate, so we'll say we'll just have to see how things go. But safe to say, Boxing Live Stories will be back next week. A reminder that we wouldn't be here at all if it wasn't for Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm in 2020. And not only do they find the best people, but they'll help you retain them. You can discover more at hansonlee.com. Before I leave you, I did say last week that there was a competition for anyone who could say who all nine people were talking in the introduction, the new introduction to Boxing Life Stories, which come courtesy of Lawrence Allen, which I think is a fantastic addition to this podcast. And the nine voices are, including mine, they include Ian Dark, Mickey Ward, Frank Bruno, Joe Calzaghe, Chris Saniger, Dickie Eklund, Tony Sims, and Teddy Atlas, and me too. Liam Tyra and John Mitchell were the two. Only a handful of people got all nine. Several people got one wrong here and there, but that's the list. Ian Dark, Mickey Ward, Frank Bruno, Joe Calzaghe, Chris Saniger, Dickie Eklund, Tony Sims, Teddy Atlas, and myself. A reminder, please, I very rarely do this, but if you can, please rate and review this podcast where possible on iTunes. Share it if you've enjoyed it on social media. It does mean a lot. You know, I'm not a guy with big corporate backers and huge big names who pump out my stuff to other people. And, you know, I'm not in that position where I have that sort of leg up. So any help is massively appreciated. And we'll be back next week.